Attention listeners, join us at the Shine Music Fest on Saturday, August 24th. Look forward to lots of fun and interactive experiences, including a live recording of the Blind Chick podcast. Learn more and RSVP at www.shinemusicfest.com/event-info.
Welcome. You are listening to the Audio Information Network of Colorado. This recording is intended to be used solely by individuals with barriers to print.
Thank you for joining us for the January 16th Sunday reading of the Denver Post. My name is Diane Adler. Today we will be reading the following main articles. COVID-19 in Colorado. This virus is just everywhere. Businesses struggle to stay adequately staffed as Omicron spreads. By Elizabeth Hernandez. Infectious disease scientists expect more variants. Also, no guarantee that existing vaccines will work. By Laura Ungar. Pacific nation of Tonga. Tsunami threat recedes from volcanic eruption. By Nick Perry. Trump administration. Census memo cites unprecedented meddling by officials. By Michael Wines. And following up with miscellaneous articles. COVID-19 in Colorado. This virus is just everywhere. Businesses struggle to stay adequately staffed as Omicron spreads. By Elizabeth Hernandez, The Denver Post. Overwhelmed by Omicron, Denver restaurants are being forced to close their doors temporarily when they don't have enough healthy workers to function. Transit officials struggle to keep buses on the road when drivers call in sick. Pharmacies have cut back the hours they're open because of understaffing. Frontline workers, whose jobs have required them to be public-facing through the pandemic, are being hit hard as COVID-19's Omicron variant tore through Colorado in the past month. Workplaces struggling with staffing as employees left over pandemic-induced burnout now are seeing more workers contracting the virus, local business owners and experts said. And it's not just hospitals and schools struggling to stay staffed amid Omicron. More and more parts of everyday life are being affected by the virus's winter surge. It feels like going back to 2020 in a lot of ways, said Nicole Sullivan, owner of Book Bar, the Denver bookstore and wine bar that's operating under reduced hours this month. I'm remembering now the exhaustion of having to constantly pivot and make new decisions and change up your business model, but it's easier because we've been there before. More than 10,000 people in Colorado had tested positive for COVID-19 on 7 of the previous 8 days as of Friday, state data shows, and the actual number infected may be significantly higher. An average of 29% of tests performed in the past week were positive, an indication that the state doesn't have a full picture of how widely the virus is spreading. Health officials estimated from 1 in 10 to 1 in 15 people in Colorado is contagious. Compared with previous iterations of the virus, Omicron is more transmissible and better able to penetrate the protections offered by vaccination and prior infection. Although the variant is less likely to cause severe illness, the number of people with COVID-19 in the state's hospitals has risen more than 60% since Christmas and surpassed the Delta variant's fall peak. Some Denver restaurants and bars began closing before Christmas as Omicron's rapid ascent was just beginning. And late December and early January saw a host of dining spots and retailers, Milk Roll Rolled Ice Cream, MI Sports Denver, and Daughter Thai Kitchen and Bar among them, announcing brief closures or altered hours because of staffing shortages. The Cow Lot, a Western wear shop in Wheat Ridge, informed customers it didn't have enough workers to operate a booth at this year's National Western Stock Show. Benzina, an Italian restaurant in Denver, was forced to close one night last week because of short staffing and keeping our neighbors safe, according to a post on social media. After about half of Book Bar's 15 employees were out with COVID-19 at the same time, Sullivan scaled back the store's January hours, going from 10 a.m. to 10 p.m. to 11 a.m. to 6 p.m. So there would be only one shift to fill during the day. She also switched to to-go orders in lieu of serving food and drinks indoors, and she canceled in-person storytime readings for the month. All it took is just one person to get sick, and we started falling like dominoes, she said. Employees who test positive are being asked to stay home for a minimum of 5 days, in keeping with guidance from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Once they no longer have symptoms, Book Bar is requiring employees to test negative before returning to work. We want to give people incentives to stay home if they're positive, or even if they have symptoms, so we're paying everybody for hours they would have worked, so our employees don't have to worry about missing pay or worry how they're going to pay bills because it's obviously not their fault if they're sick and can't come to work, Sullivan said. We're doing everything we can. The Regional Transportation District, on the other hand, is offering people financial incentives to show up. The agency said a surge of new coronavirus cases and an existing need for frontline workers are adversely impacting its ability to provide its usual transportation services. From December 15th to January 5th, the agency reported 77 new employee COVID-19 cases across facilities and operating divisions. RTD is offering a $4,000 hiring bonus the agency hopes will help with recruitment efforts amid a worker shortage, said Tina Jaquez, a RTD spokesperson. The difficult thing is we already are understaffed and trying to hire, but combining that with people calling in sick has been really challenging for us, Jaquez said. As operators call in sick, Jaquez said RTD is reaching out to workers who have signed up to pick up extra shifts, only to learn those people are sick too. Jaquez urged RTD signers to sign up for service alerts so they will be notified if a bus route drops because an operator is out sick. The other thing is we are trying to ask operators if they're able to work late. So not mandating, but asking if they're willing to work later for overtime, Jaquez said. We're just asking people to be patient. We're doing everything we can. We know it's important and a lot of people rely on us. Running a marathon with a broken leg. Scott Boyd, one of the owners of Denver-based restaurant The Rotary, said the end of 2021 and start to 2022 have been so unhinged that all he can do some days is laugh. Not only did The Rotary's two-week-old Louisville location burn down in the Marshall Fire last month, but its Denver restaurant closed to diners and switched to takeout only for a week amid a COVID-19 outbreak among the staff around the same time. Four employees testing positive on the same day triggered the switch to shut things down, Boyd said. The Rotary's Denver location has since reopened. That was the first time we've had to close because of staffing shortages, Boyd said. We've been able to make it through all of this until then, so it's at another level. This virus is just everywhere. Boyd said the company's instant messaging app was blowing up with employees informing management they tested positive for the coronavirus around the holidays, prompting the owners to make the call to switch to takeout. Opening a restaurant is hard, so if you liken that to running a marathon, running a restaurant right now is like running a marathon with a broken leg. It's hard, and now people are either sick from COVID, or you can't hire, or you can't get all the stuff because of the supply chain issues, and you're driving all over town looking everywhere for to-go paper cups for coffee, and you can't find any. It's to a point where it's almost comical, which makes it a little bit easier, he added. Sometimes when things are so bad, you can barely even believe it. You're like, okay, I can tolerate it because it doesn't even make sense how ridiculous this is. The perfect storm. People relying on accessing their prescription medications could run into obstacles as the perfect storm hits Colorado's pharmacists, according to Emily Zadorovny, executive director of the Colorado Pharmacists Society. Certain Walgreens pharmacy locations are closed on the weekends. One at 66th Avenue and Wadsworth Boulevard in Arvada, for example, because of understaffing, and others advertise on the chain's website they will be closed during certain times midday so pharmacists can eat. We have people out sick, and it's always hard to find backup staff. And we have a situation where pharmacists are not happy with their working conditions in a lot of the major chains. And there's a higher level of burnout, and they are deciding to leave, Zadvorny said. Zadvorny said there are hundreds, if not thousands, of pharmacy technician position openings in Colorado right now. In addition to what is already a demanding job, filling prescriptions, counseling patients, collecting data, and administering the usual vaccines, the pandemic has piled on the administration of COVID-19 tests and vaccinations with the same amount of workers. The most recent CDC guidance anticipated staffing shortages could become widespread and loosened requirements that healthcare workers stay home if they have COVID-19. Under normal circumstances, nurses and other hospital staff members are supposed to stay home for 10 days, unless they have a negative test and improving symptoms. In a staffing crisis, however, they can keep working, although the CDC still recommends that they do so only if they don't have a fever. Dan Weaver, a spokesman for UC Health, said the health network's employees with minor and improving cold symptoms, like a runny nose or a sore throat, aren't required to get tested, although they can choose to do so. They can continue working as long as they feel well enough, he said. Those with serious symptoms, like a fever, cough, or shortness of breath, have to be tested and stay home for at least 5 days, Weaver said. Workers who still have a fever after 5 days will need to isolate at home longer, as will those who have compromised immune systems, he said. More healthcare workers are out at the same time that patient numbers are surging, and when the field was already depleted. About 2,100 fewer people worked in Colorado hospitals in November 2021 than in February 2020, according to data from the Bureau of Labor Statistics. Pharmacies are expected always to be open and accessible, unlike other establishments, Zadvorny said. But some pharmacies are getting to the point where there aren't enough resources to do the work safely, thereby forcing closures or reduced hours. Pharmacists want to do what's right for patients, so this is a really tough time for them because what they want to do and what they're able to do right now are a little bit hard, Zadvorny said. Have some grace and some patience and understand that their workload has just inflated. Most challenging time. Because of rising costs and difficulty obtaining certain foods such as pastrami, Rosenberg's Bagels and Delicatessen owner Joshua Pollock said taking beloved items off his restaurant's menus was what worried him most a couple weeks ago. Last week, though, he found himself forced to close his Five Points and Stanley Marketplace locations for several days because of COVID-19 outbreaks among staff members. 2021 into 2022 has been the most challenging time for me as a restaurateur, Pollock said, through coughs. He and his family are suffering from COVID-19. The public opinion is that we made it through 2020 and everything is great, he said. Even my own sister is like, I don't understand. What do you mean everything is worse? 2020 was great. We got the PPE. We got government funding. And that gave us the ability to do the right thing to shut down restaurants and keep people safe. In 2020, Pollock said that the restaurant industry saw an influx of workers displaced by the pandemic from sectors such as the music industry, oil and gas, and fine dining. Now a lot of those folks are gone, leaving places understaffed and susceptible to getting rocked by Omicron. Pollock said that he recently shelled out $2,000 for COVID-19 tests because he's requiring sick employees to test negative to return to work. He said he fears if he doesn't provide the difficult-to-find tests, his employees will walk out the door and get new jobs at a different, understaffed restaurant rather than spend the time and money on a test. Anyone who knows small business knows the money we make today pays for my bills from last week. So when you're shut down for a week, you still have maybe even 30 days worth of bills to pay from the previous week, and then sick pay on top of that. And it's devastating, he said. Last week, multi-day closures, both locations had reopened by Friday, marked the third or fourth shutdowns of Rosenberg's because of the pandemic, Pollock said. He doubts they will be the last. Never, as an entrepreneur, did I ever think I would have to be so blind steering a ship through this. And it doesn't make me feel like there's an end in sight, he said. A lot of business owners are having conversations trying to figure out what can save us through all this. Denver Post staff writer Meg Wingerter contributed to this report. Infectious disease scientists expect more variants. Also, no guarantee that existing vaccines will work, by Laura Unger, the Associated Press. Get ready for more Greek letters. Scientists warn that Omicron's whirlwind advance practically ensures it won't be the last version of the coronavirus to worry the world. Every infection provides a chance for the virus to mutate, and Omicron has an edge over its predecessors. It spreads way faster despite emerging on a planet with a stronger patchwork of immunity from vaccines and prior illness. That means more people in whom the virus can further evolve. Experts don't know what the next variants will look like or how they might shape the pandemic, but they say there's no guarantee the sequels of Omicron will cause milder illness or that existing vaccines will work against them. They urge wider vaccination now, while today's shots still work. The faster Omicron spreads, the more opportunities there are for mutation, potentially leading to more variants. Leonardo Martinez, an infectious disease epidemiologist at Boston University, said, "Since it emerged in mid-November, Omicron has raced across the globe like fire through dry grass. Research shows the variant is at least twice as contagious as Delta and at least four times as contagious as the original version of the virus. Omicron is more likely than Delta to reinfect individuals who previously had COVID-19 and to cause breakthrough infections in vaccinated people while also attacking the unvaccinated." The World Health Organization reported a record 15 million new COVID-19 cases for the week of January 3rd through 9th, a 55% increase from the previous week. Along with keeping comparatively healthy people out of work and school, the ease with which the variant spreads increases the odds the virus will infect and linger inside people with weakened immune systems, giving it more time to develop potent mutations. It's the longer, persistent infections that seem to be the most likely breeding grounds for new variants, said Dr. Stuart Campbell-Ray, an infectious disease expert at Johns Hopkins University. It's only when you have very widespread infection that you're going to provide the opportunity for that to occur. Because Omicron appears to cause less severe disease than Delta, its behavior has kindled hope that it could be the start of a trend that eventually makes the virus milder, like a common cold. It's a possibility, experts say, given that viruses don't spread well if they kill their hosts very quickly. But viruses don't always get less deadly over time. A variant could also achieve its main goal, replicating. If infected people developed mild symptoms initially, spread the virus by interacting with others, then got very sick later, Ray explained by way of example. People have wondered whether the virus will evolve to mildness, but there's no particular reason for it to do so, he said. I don't think we can be confident that the virus will become less lethal over time. Getting progressively better at evading immunity helps a virus to survive over a long term. When SARS-CoV-2 first struck, no one was immune, but infections and vaccines have conferred at least some immunity to much of the world, so the virus must adapt. There are many possible avenues for evolution. Animals could incubate and unleash new variants. Pet dogs and cats, deer and farm-raised mink are only a few of the animals vulnerable to the virus, which potentially can mutate within them and leap back to people. Another possible route? With Omicron and Delta circulating, people may get double infections that could spawn what Ray calls Frankenvariants, hybrids with characteristics of both types. When new variants do develop, scientists said it's still very difficult to know from genetic features which ones might take off. For example, Omicron has many more mutations than previous variants, about 30 in the spike protein, that lets it attach to human cells. But the so-called IHU variant identified in France and being monitored by the WHO has 46 mutations and doesn't seem to have spread much at all. To curb the emergence of variants, Scientists stress continuing with public health measures such as masking and getting vaccinated. While Omicron is better able to evade immunity than Delta, experts said, vaccines still offer protection and booster shots greatly reduce serious illness, hospitalizations, and deaths. Ann Thomas, a 64-year-old IT analyst in Westerly, Rhode Island, said she's fully vaccinated and boosted and also tries to stay safe by mostly staying home while her state has one of the highest COVID-19 case rates in the U.S. I have no doubt at all that these viruses are going to continue to mutate and we're going to be dealing with this for a very long time, she said. Ray likened vaccines to armor for humanity that greatly hinders viral spread, even if it doesn't completely stop it. For a virus that spreads exponentially, he said, anything that curbs transmission can have a great effect. Also, when vaccinated people get sick, Ray said their illness is usually milder and clears more quickly, leaving less time to spawn dangerous variants. Experts say the virus won't become endemic like the flu as long as global vaccination rates are so low. During a recent press conference, WHO Director General Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus said that protecting people from future variants, including those that may be fully resistant to today's shots, depends on ending global vaccine inequity. Tedros said he'd like to see 70% of people in every country vaccinated by mid-year. Currently, there are dozens of countries where less than a quarter of the population is fully vaccinated, according to Johns Hopkins University statistics. These huge unvaccinated swaths in the U.S., Africa, Asia, Latin America, and elsewhere are basically variant factories, said Dr. Pradhat Jha of the Center for Global Health Research in Toronto. It's been a colossal failure in global leadership that we have not been able to do this. Pacific Nation of Tonga, Tsunami Threat Recedes from Volcanic Eruption, by Nick Perry, the Associated Press, byline Wellington, New Zealand. The tsunami threat around the Pacific from a huge undersea volcanic eruption began to recede Sunday, while the extent of damage to Tonga remained unclear. Satellite images showed the spectacular eruption that took place Saturday evening, with a plume of ash, steam, and gas rising like a mushroom above the blue Pacific waters. A sonic boom could be heard as far away as Alaska. In nearby Tonga, it sent tsunami waves crashing across the shore and people rushing to higher ground. The eruption cut the internet to Tonga, leaving friends and family around the world anxiously trying to get in touch to figure out if there were any injuries and the extent of the damage. Even government websites and other official sources remained without updates. Aid agencies said thick ash and smoke was continuing to affect Tonga's air and water, and that authorities were asking people to wear masks and drink bottled water. Dave Snyder, the tsunami warning coordinator for the National Tsunami Warning Center in Palmer, Alaska, said it was very unusual for a volcanic eruption to affect an entire ocean basin, and the spectacle was humbling and scary. The tsunami waves caused damage to boats as far away as New Zealand and Santa Cruz, California, but did not appear to cause any widespread damage. Snyder said he anticipated the tsunami situation in the U.S. and elsewhere to continue improving. Tsunami advisories were issued earlier for Japan, Hawaii, Alaska, and the U.S. Pacific Coast. The U.S. Geological Survey estimated the eruption caused the equivalent of a magnitude 5.8 earthquake. Scientists said tsunamis generated by volcanoes rather than earthquakes are relatively rare. The Tonga Meteorological Service said a tsunami warning was declared for all of the archipelago, and data from the Pacific Tsunami Center said waves of 2.7 feet were detected. Rachel Efeki Tumo-Ipu, who leads the New Zealand Tonga Business Council, said she hoped the relatively low level of the tsunami waves would have allowed most people to get to safety, although she worried about those living on islands closest to the volcano. She said she hadn't been able to contact her friends and family in Tonga. "We are praying that the damage is just to infrastructure and people were able to get to higher ground," she said. Tonga gets its internet via an undersea cable from Suva, Fiji, which presumably was damaged. All internet connectivity with Tonga was lost about 6:40 p.m. local time, said Doug Matery, director of internet analysis for the network intelligence firm Kentek. The Fiji-based Islands Business News site reported that a convoy of police and military troops evacuated Tonga's King Topu VI from his palace near the shore. He was among the many residents who headed for higher ground. In Tonga, home to about 105,000 people, video posted to social media showed large waves washing ashore in coastal areas and swirling around homes, a church, and other buildings. New Zealand's military said it was monitoring the situation and remained on standby, ready to assist if asked. On the Hawaiian island of Kauai, the Pacific Tsunami Warning Center reported waves that measured 1.6 feet in Niuliuli and 2.7 feet in Hanalei. In Tonga, a Twitter user identified as Dr. Faka Ilua Tonga Tumofalu posted video showing waves crashing ashore. Can literally hear the volcanic eruption. Sounds pretty violent, he wrote, adding in a later post, raining ash and tiny pebbles, darkness blanketing the sky. The explosion of the Hunga Tonga Hunga Hapa'e volcano was the latest in a series of dramatic eruptions. Earth imaging company Planet Labs PBC had watched the island in recent days after a new volcanic event there began erupting in late December. Satellite images captured by the company show how drastically the volcano had shaped the area, creating a growing island off Tonga. The surface area of the island appears to have expanded by nearly 45% due to ashfall, Planet Labs said days before the latest activity. Following Saturday's eruption, residents in Hawaii, Alaska, and along the U.S. Pacific coast were advised to move away from the coastline to higher ground and pay attention to specific instructions from their local emergency management officials, said Snyder. We don't issue an advisory for this length of coastline as we've done. I'm not sure when the last time was, but it really isn't an everyday experience, Snyder said. Savannah Peterson watched in shock as the water rose several feet in a matter of minutes in front of her oceanfront home in Pacifica, California, just south of San Francisco. It came up so fast, and a few minutes after that, it was down again. It was nuts to see that happen so quickly, she said. I've never had water come all the way up to my front door, and today it did. Police rescued a surfer whose surfboard broke in powerful waves off San Francisco. Farther south in Santa Cruz, officials were taking stock of damage after a surge damaged boats and inundated low-lying streets and parking lots, sending cars afloat. New Zealand's private forecaster WeatherWatch tweeted that people as far away as Southland, the country's southernmost region, reported hearing sonic booms from the eruption. Others reported that many boats were damaged. Trump administration. Census memo cites unprecedented meddling by officials by Michael Wines, the New York Times Company, Byline, Washington. A newly disclosed memorandum citing unprecedented meddling by the Trump administration in the 2020 census and circulated among top Census Bureau officials indicates how strongly they sought to resist efforts by the administration to manipulate the count for Republican political gain. The document was shared among three senior executives, including Ron S. Jarman, a deputy director and the agency's day-to-day leader. It was written in September 2020, as the administration was pressing the Bureau to end the count weeks early, so that if President Donald Trump lost the election in November, he could receive population estimates used to reapportion the House of Representatives before leaving office. The memo laid out a string of instances of political interference that senior census officials planned to raise with Wilbur Ross, who was then the Secretary of Commerce Department, which oversees the Bureau. The issues involved crucial technical aspects of the count, including the privacy of census respondents, the use of estimates to fill in missing population data, pressure to take shortcuts to produce population totals quickly, and political pressure on a crash program that was seeking to identify and count immigrants living in the country illegally. Most of those issues directly affected the population estimates used for reapportionment. In particular, the administration was adamant that, for the first time ever, the Bureau separately tallied the number of immigrants living illegally in each state. Trump had ordered the tally in a July 2020 presidential memorandum, saying he wanted to subtract them from House reapportionment population estimates. The census officials' memorandum pushed back, especially forcefully, complaining of direct engagement by political appointees with the methods that experts were using to find and count unauthorized non-citizens. While the presidential memorandum may be a statement of the administration's policy, the memo stated, the Census Bureau views the development of the methodology and processes as its responsibility as an independent statistical agency. The memorandum was among hundreds of documents that the Brennan Center for Justice at New York University's Law School obtained in a lawsuit seeking details of the Trump administration's plans for calculating the allotment of House seats. The suit was concluded in October, but none of the documents had been made public until now. Reached by email, Ross said he neither recalled seeing the memorandum nor discussing its contents with the Bureau's executives. A spokesman for the Census Bureau, Michael C. Cook, said he could not immediately say whether census officials actually raised the issues with Ross, or if so, what his response was. The Trump administration had long been open about its intention to change the formula for divvying up House seats among the states by excluding non-citizens from the population counts. That would leave an older and whiter population base in states with large immigrant populations, something that was presumed to work to Republicans' advantage. The Bureau proved unable to produce the non-citizen count before Trump left office, and non-citizens were counted in the allocation of House seats, just as they had been in every census since 1790. But as the documents show, that was not for lack of effort on the part of the Commerce Department and its leader at the time. Among other disclosures, undated documents show that Ross was enlisted to lobby 10 Republican governors whose states had been reluctant to turn over driver's license records and lists of people enrolled in public assistance program so that they could be screened for potential non-citizens. Time for Contesting Census is here, by Mike Schneider, the Associated Press. Detroit's mayor believes tens of thousands of residents in the majority black city were missed in the 2020 census. Leaders in Somerton, Arizona are incredulous. The Census Bureau says they lost residents during a decade when the overwhelmingly Latino community grew enough to warrant a new high school. And college towns across the U.S. believe they were undercounted as students fled campuses shuttered by the coronavirus. The time for communities with a beef about how they were counted in the 2020 census has arrived. At the start of the new year, the U.S. Census Bureau began accepting challenges from states, counties, cities, and tribal nations about one of the most difficult counts in recent memory because of the pandemic, political interference from the Trump administration, hurricanes, and wildfires. The scope for making challenges through the Count Question Resolution Program is narrow, and few local governments got their numbers changed after the 2010 census, but the Bureau has made adjustments when errors were revealed. Unprecedented hurdles in 2020 may heighten the need for tweaks this time around. Many leaders worry that inaccurate figures could cost their jurisdictions their share of the $1.5 trillion the federal government distributes annually based on census numbers. Along with concerns about undercounted racial and ethnic groups and college students, some small towns believe a new privacy method the Census Bureau used for the first time skewed their numbers. And officials in areas with large institutions, such as prisons or military barracks, worried that pandemic lockdowns left out many inmates or service members. The census challenges won't change the number of congressional seats each state gets or the numbers used for redrawing political districts. Those were released in August, so the redrawing of district lines could be completed in time for upcoming elections. At this point, it's hard to say how many governments will appeal through the program, which has been around since 1990. As of this week, the Census Bureau hadn't made public any applications, but states, cities, counties, and tribal nations have through June 2023 to submit them. State College, Pennsylvania, home to tens of thousands of students at Penn State University, plans to file a challenge this winter because officials believe 4,000 to 5,800 people were missed in the community of more than 40,500 residents, said Douglas Shantz, a Bureau spokesman. I'm not very optimistic, but we're going to explore every route we can to ensure everyone in State College was properly counted, Shantz said in an email. The lack of optimism may be because the scope of challenges is narrow, for mistakes made in recording boundaries or housing that was skipped over during census processing. In years past, only a few were successful. Revisions to population and housing totals were made to about 1% of the nation's 39,000 governments after the 2010 census. Unfortunately, the program hasn't resulted in many changes, which might be discouraging. But this is a really important opportunity to fix the numbers, said Kara Brumfield, a senior policy analyst at the Georgetown Center on Poverty and Inequality. When they do succeed, challenges can have significant impact. After the 2010 census, Houston got its population count revised from 2.09 million to 2.1 million. The addition of 812 previously uncounted residents triggered the addition of two city council seats. Some demographers and local government officials say the program should allow for challenges for other problems, including mistakes by census takers or managers. Some say they need more latitude to use administrative records to show errors in the headcount. We propose that human error during census-taking field operations should have a remedy if such errors are detected and substantiated, said Todd Graham, principal demographer for the Metropolitan Council of the Twin Cities, in public comments on the program. Citing concerns about residents being missed in Detroit, the House Committee on Oversight and Reform on Thursday asked the Census Bureau for a briefing on whether communities might be able to challenge and fix their population counts if an undercount is documented. Local governments soon will have another way to change the numbers. Starting next year, they can hire the Census Bureau to conduct a special census in a redo of the 2020 count, with the locals footing the bill. They can also challenge population estimates that use the census figures as a base upon which deaths, births, and migration are added annually. Given the 2020 problems counting people in dorms, military barracks, nursing homes, and prisons during the pandemic, the Census Bureau has proposed creating a separate program to accept challenges for these group quarters. State, city, and tribal officials have been sounding the alarm about the counts because students were sent home from campuses and prisons and nursing homes went into lockdowns when those residents were supposed to be counted. Brumfield called the proposal a step in the right direction. Any changes will be incorporated into future population estimates and the Bureau's American Community Survey under the proposal. I'm optimistic it will address a lot of concerns, Brumfield said. It's a good sign that the Bureau has been listening. Transportation. POLA seeks delay of gas fee. Law is supposed to go into effect this summer and raise $5 billion for roads, bridges, public transit. By Alex Burness, The Denver Post. Barely 6 months after Governor Jared POLA signed a landmark transportation funding bill, the governor is seeking to temporarily undo a key provision, initiating a 2 cents per gallon fee on gasoline. His proposal has Republicans, who all along blasted the fee increase, accusing POLA of cynically copying their messaging in an election year. Democrats say that delaying until January a scheduled increase in this fee effectively attacks most in the capital acknowledge, doesn't compromise any climate action goals, and is consistent with their longstanding objective to help people save money, especially those who are struggling. The bill POLA signed in June, SB21-260, is set to go into effect this summer and projects to raise more than $5 billion by 2032. Democrats and a small crew of Republicans who backed the bill celebrated this plan as an historic achievement. At one point, they held a packed news conference in the Capitol foyer, at which POLA emphasized, "It's time to fix our damn roads." The reason for this enthusiasm? This bill promises a huge increase in transportation funding over previous years when legislators repeatedly tried and failed to create significant and reliable new funding streams for roads and bridges, public transit, and non-vehicle projects, such as bike paths. The gas fee is integral to this plan, with SB21-260 promising to raise it by 2 cents per gallon this year and another 1 cent annually through 2028. Analysts projected that these penny-sized increases would add up to $1.6 billion by 2032. Democrats said and say now that the increases are so small that drivers will barely notice them. Republican lawmakers and political operatives have spent the better part of a year campaigning vigorously against it. When the GOP unveiled its Commitment to Colorado agenda during the summer, it did so at a Denver gas station. Polis is now, for the moment, opposed to this increase, too. He's proposing a slew of fee reductions and banking much of his election messaging on cost savings. Look, what the legislature, as part of the bipartisan transportation bill, decided is that over time, the gas tax will be adjusted for inflation, he told reporters on the Capitol steps Monday. What I think we can all agree on now is not the time. When families are struggling to keep up with costs, now is not the time for the gas tax to keep up with inflation. If that's a good policy in the long term to help make sure that we have less traffic, that's a fine thing. But now is not the time. Let's show people relief at the pump. Democratic leaders in the legislature, including the lead sponsors of the transportation bill, are prepared to go along with the governor's proposal, which will need approval through the state budgeting process in March and April. Now suddenly, Democrats claim that they want Coloradans to keep more of their hard-earned money in their pocket. Senate Minority Leader Chris Hulbert of Douglas County said at a news conference Wednesday, mockingly added, "We look forward to their support." Transportation is now the biggest contributor to greenhouse gas emissions of any sector in the state. Climate activists have long argued that Colorado needed to recognize and combat this by taxing, and in some cases actively discouraging, driving in single-occupant vehicles in particular. Senate Majority Leader Steve Fenberg, a Boulder Democrat who sponsored the transportation bill, said delaying implementation of the gas fee says nothing about Democrats' climate commitment. A couple of pennies of the gas tax was not meant to say, "Hey, we're going to make gas 2 cents per gallon more expensive, therefore you're not going to drive anymore." No, it was to raise revenue, because Utah has a 50-cent gas tax, and we have a 28-cent gas tax, and it doesn't go up with inflation. It was purely about revenue, he said. His Senate co-sponsor on the bill, Democrat Faith Winter of Westminster, is one of the fiercest advocates for urgent climate action in the legislature. She spent all of last session battling the governor's office on climate policy, with billions in federal stimulus money bolstering the state's budget, and with Congress having passed a new infrastructure spending package that will send billions to further assist Colorado's transportation efforts, the state can afford to delay the gas fee without delaying climate action, she argued. We have unprecedented resources from the federal government that at this time we should use first before we ask our citizens to pay extra, she said. We can meet our climate goals with the resources we have right now, and the gas fee was about resources and implementation. Republicans say the timing is curious. Polis is up for re-election in November, and many sitting lawmakers are on the ballot as well. They don't buy the Democrats are serious about saving people money when a transportation law that relies on increased fees is not even a year old. Affordability isn't just a talking point to Republicans, Weld County GOP Senator Barbara Kirkmeyer said Tuesday. Fenberg said Republicans have had plenty of opportunities to demonstrate they're serious about lowering costs. The GOP was nowhere to be found when Democrats last year moved to reduce health care costs and costs for renters who might be at risk of eviction. Fenberg said Democrats might well be okay with some of the GOP ideas for this session, including eliminating sales tax on food and allowing some renters relief on income taxes. But, he said, Republicans never floated these ideas to Democrats before the session. He said he thinks that indicates they want to make a point more than they want to actually pass legislation. In news briefs, rental exemptions okayed for those housing people displaced by fire. Byline Boulder. The city will allow exemptions to its rental housing licensing requirements to provide additional housing for people in need after the Marshall and Middle Fork fires and the hurricane force winds that contributed to them. The order, signed Thursday, is meant to prevent displacement or possible homelessness and will exempt new rental properties used to house those affected by the various disasters from having to obtain a rental license. Instead, people will need to submit an affidavit of exemption showing the property is being used to house people who have been displaced by the fires or wind, as well as a current rental housing inspector's certification of rental inspection report. Former vice president files lawsuit against Ames Community College. Byline Greeley. A former Ames Community College vice president filed a lawsuit Thursday against the college on claims of discrimination and a hostile work environment based on gender and retaliation, as well as discrimination based on gender and a retaliation, according to documents. Patricia Rand, who worked at Ames for nearly 17 years before resigning last fall as an associate vice president of academic affairs, filed the lawsuit in Weld County District Court. Rand is seeking more than $100,000, including penalties or punitive damages, but excluding attorney's fees, interest, and costs, according to the lawsuit. Rand is requesting a jury trial. The lawsuit says Rand experienced constant gender discrimination and a hostile work environment. After she reported the work environment, Rand faced retaliation from her supervisor. Four pedestrians injured by vehicles in metro area. A pedestrian was injured by a hit-and-run driver in Denver on Friday night, and on Saturday, three pedestrians were hit by a driver who was taken into custody in Adams County. The Denver hit-and-run happened about 8:45 p.m. Friday at West 11th Avenue and Bannock Street, according to police. The pedestrian, a man, was taken to a hospital with serious injuries. The driver remained at large as of Saturday. Police are asking anyone with information to call 720-913-7867. In Adams County on Saturday, three people were hit by a driver at West 63rd Avenue and Federal Boulevard, according to the sheriff's office. All three were taken to hospitals to be treated. One was in critical condition, the sheriff's office said. These were from staff and wire reports. Marshall Fire. Evacuation raises questions about emergency alerts. By Noelle Phillips, The Denver Post. In the first 4 hours of the Marshall Fire's terrorizing run through Boulder County, emergency officials sent 24,289 alerts to residents' cell phones. As firefighters, sheriff's deputies, police officers, and even public works employees raced through neighborhoods to sound the alarm. Even with officials employing multiple methods, including social media, to tell people to get out, last month's fast-moving wildfire raised questions about the effectiveness of systems such as reverse 911. Many residents said they never received an evacuation notice, but managed to escape because they could see the danger out their windows. And as climate change contributes to more severe natural disasters such as wildfires, floods, and tornadoes, survivors of the Marshall Fire say now is the time to improve Colorado's emergency notification systems. My thought is just that perhaps it is time to reevaluate our early alert system, said Lindsay Smith, a Louisville resident who fled the fire with her sons. I recognize it's a fast-moving fire and they struggled with it, but it's a good time to look at the system. A lot of people could have saved family, pets, and valuables. The Marshall Fire showed how difficult emergency notifications can be in the cell phone age, with technology rapidly changing and local governments trying to stay up to date in an arena that is highly regulated by the federal government. In Boulder County, an emergency alert system purchase in late 2019 required people to register online to receive alerts on their cell phones, but many people in the county said they did not know about it until the fire was blazing. Mike Chard, director of the Boulder Office of Emergency Management, said Boulder County had hoped to have its new emergency alert system fully operational much sooner, but plans to get it going have been disrupted repeatedly by virus outbreaks, the 2020 Cal Wood fire, burn scar floods, and the mass shooting at a Boulder King Supers. "We've been hit with every disaster you can imagine in the last 18 months," Chard said. "I'm glad we didn't stall out, but I wish we could have gotten it done sooner." Boulder County hasn't been alone in its efforts to keep up. In Denver, residents have not been able to sign up for cell phone emergency alerts since the city purchased a new system in late 2019, said Andrew Dameron, the city's 911 director. Denver hopes its new early alert system, which is the same one used by Boulder, is online by the end of the month. Personnel losses, the pandemic, and all the complications with it caused a delay with getting it up and running, he said. And 13 Colorado counties serving a population of nearly 115,000 people are not authorized to send emergency alerts straight to residents' cell phones. Most of those counties are on the Eastern Plains or within the state's southeastern corner. Of those, five are going through the process to become certified to issue cell phone alerts. The others have not started putting a system in place, according to a map created by the Colorado Department of Homeland Security. The Marshall Fire killed at least one person. Remains of Robert Sharp, 69, were found 6 days after the fire, and Nadine Turnbull, a 91-year-old Superior resident whose home was destroyed, is still missing. It's unclear whether they received any kind of emergency notification as the fire, fueled by strong winds, tore through unincorporated Boulder County and into Superior and Louisville on December 30th. The 6,000-acre wildfire damaged or destroyed 1,270 homes and businesses. The estimates on damage exceed $500 million, making it the most destructive fire in Colorado history. A series of alerts. The lack of widespread emergency alerts to residents' phones happened as Boulder County works to integrate its emergency communications system with a federally controlled wireless emergency alert system, a project that was delayed when the pandemic struck and forced the county's attention toward that crisis. The Boulder County Office of Emergency Management said in a lengthy explanation of how emergency notification unfolded during the wildfire. To send emergency alerts, a local agency must be authorized by the Federal Emergency Management Agency and then hire a private company to build a digital portal that makes it happen. Boulder had taken both steps, Chard said, but installing a completely operational system is a complex project that involves planning, mapping, training, and even following guidelines on specific terminology. Boulder County's five-page memo on what happened during the Marshall Fire evacuation was released January 6th in response to complaints from residents. The document includes a timeline of 9 evacuation orders that were sent via the county's Everbridge emergency notification system over the course of 4 hours. Everbridge, which was purchased by Boulder County in late 2019, automatically sends notifications to landlines because telephone companies update their databases into the system regularly, the Boulder County memo said. But databases of cell phone users essentially don't exist, said Dameron, Denver's 911 director. That's because people use numbers they got years ago when they lived in other places or remain on a family plan, even though they no longer live with their parents. So counties ask people who only use cell phones to voluntarily enroll in these programs online. There's no such thing as reliable databases for cell phones, he said. The first Marshall Fire evacuation order was sent at 11:47 a.m. to 215 contacts, the county's memo said. That notification said an evacuation order was in place for the area of Colorado 93 and Marshall Road. By then, the fire had been burning for more than 40 minutes. A second evacuation order was sent at 12:15 p.m. to 2,588 phone numbers as the fire moved quickly and endangered more lives, according to the timeline. And the largest evacuation alerted 7,251 phone contacts at 1:08 p.m., notifying people in the area of McCaslin Boulevard and U.S. 36 to leave. The final order went to 2,217 people at 2:58 p.m. Ultimately, the entire populations of Superior and Louisville, 34,320 people, and parts of unincorporated Boulder County were ordered to evacuate, but the messages sent to phones never instructed everyone to get out of Superior, according to the timeline. A message about a mandatory evacuation for the city of Louisville was sent to 4,806 people at 2:51 p.m. Firefighters and police officers also drove through neighborhoods to spread word about the evacuations, the memo said. In a January 4th City Council meeting, the Louisville Fire Chief said Police Works employees also were driving through neighborhoods to tell people to get out. Thank you for joining us for the Denver Post. My name is Diane Adler.